I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A court ruled on Friday and yesterday that the names of the so-called unindicted co-conspirators in the Bridgegate scandal in New Jersey will remain secret for now. A John Doe had appealed to the court, saying that the release of his name would brand him as a criminal without the due process of a trial. A group of news organizations had asked the court that these names be released because of the public interest in the case, and a judge had agreed. A hearing is set for early June for oral arguments. It's been almost 3 years since the lanes of the George Washington Bridge were closed down to allegedly punish the mayor of Fort Lee for not supporting Governor Chris Christie in his bid for re-election. The governor has denied any involvement in or knowledge of the lane closure decisions. Well, here to catch us up on all the news, we have two guests, including Matt Katz, who joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. He's been covering Chris Christie for 5 years, works now for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. In fact, he and a team of WNYC reporters won a Peabody Award for their coverage of Christie and the Bridgegate scandal. Wrote a book about Governor Christie, American Governor Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption, and he's now been covering Donald Trump for WNYC. And Matt Katz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And joining us by telephone is Ted Mann, a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And Ted, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here.
Let me start with you, Matt, and just start with the fact that both your news organizations, part of this consortium of media outlets that want access to these unindicted co-conspirator names. Why?
We understand from all the court documents that have been filed in this case, and there have been hundreds of thousands of them, that there's this list of people who were involved in the conspiracy to close down the bridge or close down the lanes of the bridge back in September 2013, but they were not indicted. Perhaps the prosecutors had enough evidence to indict, but not beyond a reasonable doubt. So maybe they didn't think they could get a conviction. These lists have been these names. Names in other cases have been available to the public. It's in all likelihood during the trial they could be brought up, perhaps by the defense. So we want to see the names as soon as possible. And a federal court judge did rule in our favor and said that we should have access to them. But at the last minute, before we were supposed to be getting this list last week. Somebody by the name of John Doe, not his real name, somebody filed a motion before the court to block the release. John Doe said that he would suffer irreparable harm to his reputation if his name came out because he would be branded a criminal. And there have been a series, and the media organizations then responded, and there's been a fight now about whether John Doe's identity will be released. And it just got, the case is now at the appellate court level, and we're waiting on a hearing in June 6th, about whether we're able to see both who John Doe is and who the rest of the people on the list are.
Well, and Ted, let me get you in on the conversation. Does anyone know who is on this list and who this John Doe is?
I think there are a number of educated guesses about who is likely to be on this list, because this was a conspiracy, you know, in the words of the prosecution, that involved both members of the governor's office staff and the appointees and allies of his at the Port Authority, people who were in those two organizations who the government may believe knew some of what was going on are the people most likely to be on the list. And that was the reasoning, part of the reasoning in the federal judge who ruled in our favor, that there was no great expectation of privacy, especially because most of the people likely to be on this list are public employees or public officials. But no one knows for sure who John Doe is. And I think a lot of people are trying to figure it out, but no answers yet.
No answers yet. Well, the U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman wants to keep this information private as well, quoted as saying federal prosecutors should remain sensitive to the privacy and reputation interests of uncharged third parties. And this is Paul Fishman, who has been investigating this case, Matt.
He's the one who is prosecuting this case, and this is all it's all preparing us for the trial, which is in September. There are Christie's former deputy chief of staff has been charged and pleaded not guilty. That's Bridget Ann Kelly. And his number two guy at the Port Authority, I guess his number one guy, he had a staffer there, the top staffer at the Port Authority, Bill Baroni. He's also pleaded not guilty, and he's been charged. And Bill Baroni's number two, David Wildstein, has pleaded guilty and is expected to cooperate. Fishman was the U.S. attorney who actually took over the position from Chris Christie, who was used to be the U.S. attorney of New Jersey. He was in the courtroom for a hearing a couple of weeks ago. This is a high-profile case for him, but he has seems to be taking some care about not, you know, being too grandstanding about this whole situation, not looking like he's out to expose every, you know, fatal flaw of the Christie administration.
Well, Ted, let me go back to you. And I was saying to Matt before going on the air, every time I describe the Bridgegate scandal, I always have to scratch my head and say, this is really what we're talking about. And I know you were one of the early journalists who got wind of what was going on. Can you take us back to almost 3 years ago?
Sure. I think a lot of people scratched their heads about it. It seemed too weird and petty and strange to be real, but it was. I think for a lot of us, certainly for me, I got a tip that there was a real sort of firestorm within the Port Authority, and was told by someone to just give them a call and ask for an explanation of what had been going on in Fort Lee. And what we got was a statement that we now know is a lie. The original statement actually is not even the explanation that Bill Baroni later gave to the legislature. It was that they were doing a traffic safety study, which just isn't remotely true and has been disputed by the local officials there. But yeah, the allegation is that after lengthy discussions of whether or not the mayor of Fort Lee, a Democrat named Mark Sokolich, might be one of the Democratic mayors who would come across party lines and endorse Christie's reelection, at some point the campaign seems to have realized he wasn't going to do that. And then the allegation of the government is that that is when Kelly and David Wildstein, and with Baroni sort of along for the ride, it sounds like, decided to shut down these local access lanes and inundate the town with traffic, just flood the town on the first day of school and the succeeding mornings for the remainder of that week. And one of the things that was happening, we were told, right away, drivers who would pull up to a Port Authority police officer trying to figure out what was wrong and why the lanes were closed were all told to just go talk to the mayor. Yeah. So from the view of the government and from, participants like Wildstein, this was pretty clearly just a very simple but very heavy-handed payback scheme. It was something that was hard in the very beginning to believe that these people in these positions had actually done something that was seemingly, so silly and also so potentially dangerous.
We have a tweet from Ed just picking up on this. Matt says, a bridge was closed for a day and you're still talking about it almost 3 years later.
Well, Ed, it was actually 5 days and it was five mornings in a row.
That's right.
This is the busiest bridge in the world. And there were the severity of this should not be understated. There were ambulance drivers who had to get out of their vehicle and run to the scene of car accidents and other emergencies because there was so much traffic. The federal government alleges that this was done on the very first day of school in Fort Lee in order to maximize the pain that children and their parents would feel over this. There are school buses stuck in traffic for hours. There are people who have to, get dialysis who are stuck in traffic for hours. There were lost wages for taxi drivers for a full week. This involved and affected thousands and thousands of people in a very high traffic area in the most congested part of the country. So, it sounds somewhat ridiculous when you talk about a traffic jam, but you're talking about highly paid public officials who are using public resources to exert political revenge. And when you do something like that, it's quite a slippery slope about what other things such people could do, especially involved in an agency, the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, which ran the bridge, which has a bigger budget than many U.S. states, that runs three airports, that has access to highly sensitive information, and there could have been all kinds of other shenanigans going on, and this was a window into a lot of other corruption that was happening at the time.
Go ahead, Ted. Yes, please.
We hear that all the time. That sort of question in that vein. Well, how can you still be talking about this? This is no big deal to the voters of Iowa or New Hampshire. Why are you continuing to talk about traffic? There's an even simpler explanation, and I agree with everything Matt just said, and that is that since this happened, literally since the first day someone told me about it, we've been trying to get a straight answer. Who did this? Exactly who? Why did they do it? And how did they get away with it for so long? And we haven't gotten a straight answer. This is something the government did and has not fully explained. And prosecutors are trying to get to the bottom of that, but so are we. And the notion that at some point it's just old news when we don't know why it was done, it's just not how it works.
Well, Ted, picking up on that, wasn't it Bridget Kelly who emailed time for some traffic problems on the George Washington Bridge?
That is the smoking gun. Yes.
That literally is a smoking gun.
Well, I mean, certainly that is up until that point, this was a scandal that was building, and it was a matter of tremendous tension all of that fall within the Port Authority and within the administration of Governor Christie. But I think it was somewhat contained. I know WNYC was working on it. We were doing stories about it. The Record was doing stories about it. And the legislature was beginning to investigate, and they used subpoena power that they had actually acquired for another reason to get documents from David Wildstein and from others within the administration. Mm-hmm. And it was when those communications that Wildstein turned over included what certainly appears to everyone who has read it to be a direct acknowledgement that they were going to intentionally inflict traffic on a community and not tell the mayor and not tell the cops and not tell the New York officials who also are responsible for the bridge. It just, the notion that there was a statement in there that was so seeming, that implicated them so directly in this being intentional was a shock. And I think since then there was just, there was no putting anything back into the tube.
Matt, we're almost having a break here. Chris Christie has said about this list of unindicted co-conspirators, he said it's, quote, highly doubtful that he is on the list.
And that very well may be the case, but we should note that there is a second list that the media is now trying to get. The judge has not ruled about on this list. And this list is people who were aware of the conspiracy but did not actually participate in it. And that is the accusation against Christie from David Wildstein, who has pleaded mm-hmm. guilty, from his lawyer, that he told Christie about this that Christie was aware of this. And we know from photographs that Christie and Wildstein had a conversation while the lanes were closed. So it's unlikely that Christie is on this first list, but this second list, aware of it and not participating in the conspiracy, could be a liability for Christie.
Well, we're getting an update on the Bridgegate scandal involving the George Washington Bridge and lane closures almost 3 years ago, September of 2014. Is that right? 2014? Matt Katz and Ted Mann are guests in this hour of Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're getting the latest on the Bridgegate scandal. A group of media organizations, including the media organizations our guests work for, have petitioned the court overseeing the scandal to release the names of unindicted co-conspirators. These names were set to be made public last week, but the court has twice delayed the action, including just yesterday. And again, talking with Matt Katz of WNYC and Ted Mann of The Wall Street Journal. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Matt, you mentioned the fact that Bridget Kelly and Baroni have both been charged, but they have pled not guilty.
That's correct. And their lawyers are saying that among their many arguments is that they do not There is no constitutional right not to be stuck in traffic. They have yet to make the argument that they were, taking orders and that there were people above them who were making these decisions. Although their attorneys have insinuated that they might go there during trial, and that would certainly be interesting if they were to allege that Christie or his closest aides and allies were involved in this as well. It is certainly plausible, therefore, that Christie himself could be called to testify during the September trial. So they're making several arguments, but among them is that but it comes down to the fact that there was no federal crime here, is what they're saying, and even the U.S. attorney has acknowledged there is very little precedent for charging somebody with the crimes that they charge them. I mean, this is a crazy, odd thing.
So trying to figure that up. And back to you, Ted. The trial is set for, what, September, which would be 3 years after the lane closures. I don't know, in judicial terms, is that a long time? Is that not a long time?
That may be a question for someone at a higher pay grade than me, but certainly the people who are tied up in this case and the related investigations at the Port Authority have been, I think, very frustrated by being in limbo so long. I was talking to one of them who is, you know, likely a witness to some of this stuff recently, who said, yeah, this has dragged on longer than anyone ever anticipated, and the result is like a real interruption of people's lives. It really has dragged, and I think that, you know, certainly the pace at which Fishman is moving has been, you know, very deliberate. All of us on the outside have all been trying to figure out what, if anything, we can deduce from that. It's September now, but I think could continue to slide depending on how much more wrangling there is between now and the start of the trial.
And has Fishman kept things pretty close to the vest, Ted?
He has. I talked to someone the other day who has worked with him in the past, and this actually goes to the question that we're fighting over on this conspirators list. He is described as being relatively conservative about the way he discloses information over the course of a prosecution. So sometimes, and this is true in other, you know, jurisdictions currently, you will get prosecutors who make in a big case, they will present an indictment, and it will essentially be a speaking indictment. There is a lot of narrative in there. There's a lot of detail. There are a lot of, you know, I don't want to call them hints, but there are threads to chase if you are Matt or me, figuring out who they're talking about and who else is implicated. And the person I was discussing Fishman with said that's sort of the opposite of his style, that he is much more of a cards close to the vest kind of guy, and that, you know, just that's his philosophy of how to approach this, and that helps explain why they really are fighting the notion that they should have to say, here's who else knew. Here's who else, you know, knew but did nothing. Here's who else knew and actually was kind of helping out on what they're saying was a pretty, you know, broad conspiracy.
Well, Matt, just to get even more complicated here, as we know, Chris Christie ran for president, didn't do particularly well. He's now part of Donald Trump's inner circle. We see him from time to time in that frame when Donald Trump is talking. He's heading up his transition team. And Donald Trump had criticized Chris Christie for his handling or mishandling or his alleged involvement in the Bridgegate scandal. Where does this stand now? And we should add one more little wrinkle here. Donald Trump's sister is a judge.
Yes, that's right. It's gotten quite dramatic in the last week or two. You can't make this stuff up. 6 months ago in December, when Christie was still running, Donald Trump went further than any political opponent to Christie ever had and said that Christie actually knew about Bridgegate. Christie was starting to inch up a little bit in the polls. He had knocked Trump about his wall and his Muslim ban. And so Trump got up at a speech and said, oh, he knew about it. He totally knew about it. Trust me, Chris knew. There's a 0.2% chance he didn't know. He has breakfast with these guys all the time.
You're quoting Trump
here,
pretty much.
Yes, that's what Trump said. And yet, you know, despite all that, 3 months later, Christie drops out of the race and decides to endorse Trump. And now these guys are very tight. And Trump, even though he alleged that Christie committed a federal crime, has named him the head of his transition team, as you said. And now we have this case involving this John Doe and the release of these names of co-conspirators. And it's been kicked up to the federal appellate court for a hearing next month. And who sits on the federal appellate court but Donald Trump's sister, Marianne Trump? Trump Barry. She's been a judge since 1983, got the position in part because her brother's political connections was named at first by Ronald Reagan, then got elevated by President Clinton. And now she's one of, I think, 24 judges on this court. And she could be one of three who are chosen for a panel to hear about whether and decide whether this list of Bridgegate co-conspirators should be released. So now, you know, legal experts think that she'll likely recuse herself.
I was just going to ask you that, yeah.
And certainly she could. This panel meets in Philadelphia, actually, in June. And so presumably she would. But it's just fascinating how all these relationships are tied together. And even more bizarre is tomorrow in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, Donald Trump is rallying with Chris Christie. And unusual for a Donald Trump rally, in fact, unprecedented, he's charging $200 a head. And that money will go to retire Christie's presidential campaign debt. But there's another fundraiser before that, and that's a private fundraiser in a conference room. There's only going to be about 20 people there. That's $25,000 a head. And that money is going to the New Jersey Republican State Committee to pay off their Bridgegate legal fees, because the state Republicans in New Jersey got subpoenaed after all this stuff came out in 2014. So Donald Trump, who thinks Christie is guilty for Bridgegate, is now raising money to pay Christie's Bridgegate legal fees. It's been a strange election.
This is the time
election
that we live in.
Yeah.
Ted, picking up on that, do we know how much money has been spent by all parties in this Bridgegate investigation?
I don't know that we could know all parties, because that would require, knowing about some of the private entities, you know, some of whose names obviously we don't know who are paying lawyers. But we're way up in the millions, and that includes payments by the government of New Jersey to pay for lawyers representing the office of the governor. The Port Authority has had its own legal costs, has had, you know, the costs of indemnification, which is where they would be paying for attorneys for employees of the port who have been sort of sucked into this. That will take a while to sort out, because a lot of this is still ongoing, and we don't actually know the scope or the ultimate result of some of the other investigations that have spiraled out of this. For instance, the other thing Paul Fishman is doing related to the Port Authority, they sort of, you could argue that this bridge scandal let the wolf in the door a little bit, and now Fishman is investigating David Sampson, who was the former chairman of the Port Authority, and, you know, basically trying to, as best we can tell, figure out if he was using that position to extract things of benefit from other entities with business before the port, especially United Airlines. And so all of that has just spiraled and consumed, you know, not just legal fees, but a tremendous amount of other resources like time and energy and focus from, you know, a pretty large swath of the government here, both in New York and New Jersey.
Let me just reintroduce the two of you. That's Ted Manny's, a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. With us as well, Matt Katz, a reporter with WNYC, getting an update on Bridgegate, the various twists and turns. And it does feel it's getting even more complicated as we look at almost 3 years, 2013, just to correct myself earlier in the hour. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments that you might have? We got a bunch of emails here, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Matt, picking up on what Ted was just saying, an email from Joseph says, I hope you touch on the way the Port Authority handled zoning in Hoboken and David Sampson's role in it. This issue was raised earlier in the investigation. I haven't heard much about it lately. This always seems like it's an important issue to be talking about. And Ted mentioned the fact of Sampson and airlines, and it seemed like he had a deal to get a special plane that took him to his weekend house somewhere?
Right. There's two allegations here that I'll separate. First, there was an allegation by the mayor of Hoboken that there was a shakedown scheme by the Christie administration to get her to approve a redevelopment project that Sampson Christie's friend and the chairman of the Port Authority had a financial interest in.
And that was Don Zimmer.
That was Don Zimmer, correct. And that matter is not under investigation. The U.S. attorney essentially said that they're not pursuing it after they had investigated it for quite some time. So that's basically over and done with one way or another. The second allegation is something that is much more serious and has already possibly claimed the position of the head of United Airlines. Here you have David Sampson, head of the Port Authority. They're in charge of the Newark Airport. And when he started the gig, the allegation is that he had United Airlines create a flight to South Carolina because he had a weekend home there and there was no flight out of Newark Airport. So they created this flight route specifically for him. They called it the Chairman's Flight. It was the least used flight out of Newark Airport. It left on Thursdays, came back on Sundays, which is perfect for a weekend getaway. And once he quit as chairman due to, you know, some smoke related to Bridgegate, they stopped the flight the next day. And he was in exchange going to do some favors for United Airlines related to their fees to use Newark Airport. That's the allegation. Now, this has been under investigation for quite some time. There has been news stories by Ted and others about this. There were lobbyists involved and other intermediaries, and we understand that people have been, you know, testifying to grand juries about this, we have all been expecting a possible indictment of either Sampson or others for quite some time. But as Ted said, the U.S. attorney moves at a relatively slow pace.
Ted, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I would just add, I mean, Matt's summation was right. The chairman's flight was actually a resumption of a route that had been canceled because it didn't make money or didn't make enough money. You know, these airlines are pretty cost conscious. The other thing is that we do know that Jeff Smyzik had to leave as CEO of United, at least indirectly, because of this. The United, when they announced that Smyzik was resigning along with two other United executives, said it was as a result of the internal investigation that United did after being contacted by the federal prosecutors who are investigating this entire arrangement. So there was something at least indirect that related what was going on with Sampson to the CEO of a major airline having to step down.
Ted, is there any way to know how people in New Jersey feel about this investigation, if there's quote-unquote public opinion on where it's going or the various allegations involved?
That's a good question. I'd be really curious if – I don't know if Matt has seen data more recently than I have. This is much more anecdotal, but in the course of covering it, we definitely ran into some of what you sort of heard from the guy on Twitter a little earlier. There are people who feel like they heard all about this. It was weird, and it was kind of stupid, and it was sort of crazy, and you know, it just dominated a bunch of news cycles. And then after a while, I think a lot of people felt like it was over. And I think some of the participants or, you know, people loosely connected to it felt like it was over or it had gone away. But really, it has just been on a back burner, kind of simmering away for a long time. So I think that the people who follow it most closely have known and are not surprised that all of a sudden this week and last week it's back in the news. They have always known this was coming back. They've always known that there are huge unanswered questions that go right to the top of the state of New Jersey, right to the top of the Port Authority about who knew what and when. For Christie himself, that he has been knows that Wildstein is trying to put him in the soup on this. And, you know, from the very beginning has been very explicit about exactly what he is saying about his own knowledge, that he didn't know of it ahead of time, that he wasn't involved in this conspiracy in any way, he wasn't involved in planning it, and that he doesn't recall if Wildstein brought it up to him that week. Because he knows that if this ever goes to a courtroom, there could be a guy sitting in a witness chair saying, yeah, I told on Wednesday, September 11th, at the World Trade Center Memorial, I told the governor of New Jersey we're really creating a lot of traffic in Fort Lee, and that he needs to have a plausible story, which we you know, take and give the benefit of the doubt, that he didn't, even if that was said to him, he doesn't understand what it meant. So that these have always been huge unanswered questions that have been looming, and we're not ever really going to go away without without some sort of conclusion.
Let me read an email from Diane in New Jersey. She says, it's horrific to me that just a few days after the most devastating tragedy this nation suffered on September 11th, politicians would mess around with a GW bridge for juvenile revenge purposes. This has far greater ramifications than traffic and inconvenience. This easily can be considered an infringement and assault on Homeland Security. Obviously, a very different opinion from the guy that sent us the tweet, Matt.
And that's a legitimate thought. I mean, this actually did happen. It was over 5 days, and one of those days was September 11th. It was the 12th anniversary of September 11th, and the George Washington Bridge has been a known terrorist target by extremists abroad. So we know that there was a legitimate concern. And, you know, on this other stuff with the chairman's flight and the Port Authority and the tweeter earlier saying that this is no big deal, all these other related scandals we would not have known about if Bridgegate hadn't sort of blown open the doors to expose what was really happening within these government agencies. It goes beyond the chairman's flight and Bridgegate to lower level stuff. Like, we found all these documents that ended up being subpoenaed and released from the governor's office indicating that taxpayer-funded staffers on government time were going out and getting endorsements for the governor and using mm-hmm. government paper to type up lists of potential targets for endorsements, doing clear political activity on government time, that they were using gifts giving gifts to mayors whom they wanted to support the governor in his reelection. And those gifts came from Ground Zero. There were burnt steel mm-hmm. from the World Trade Center that Christie's operatives from the Port Authority were funneling over to the governor's office and then handing out to mayors whose favor they wanted to covet.
There was just profound dysfunction, too. I mean,
you know what, Ted, only just because we're up on a break here, and I want to hear what you have to say, but we do need to take a very short break, and then we will get back to our conversation. And I see a lot of people want to join us as well. Getting an update on the Bridgegate scandal from two people who have been covering this in great detail from the get-go. Ted Mann, Ray Porter at the Wall Street Journal, joining us by telephone. Matt Katz here with us in our Philadelphia studio. He's been covering this issue for a number of years now, and now is working for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we're talking about Bridgegate. That's a scandal involving the allegedly deliberate lane closures on the George Washington Bridge as a means of political retaliation for the mayor of Fort Lee. I know that still sounds, after almost 3 years, kind of ridiculous, but that is at the heart of Bridgegate. And again, Matt Katz and Ted Mann are guests, and folks are calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I'll read a bunch of emails as well, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ted, you were going to say something right before the break. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I'm just to sort of back up Matt's point. I mean, the way this scandal sort of blew up was in part that when the New York side of the Port Authority, and it's a very evenly divided agency, when they found out what was being done with this vital bridge, they just completely hit the ceiling and freaked out. And there was an incredibly angry email from the executive director, who's a New York official. But what then kind of, you know, spilled into the light, and what we're still finding out about even years later, is just how dysfunctional things were within that agency at the time. We had a story just a month ago or so, based on some public records that came out that were emails exchanged right after the lane closures had been discovered and the lanes had been reopened, where it becomes clear that the New York officials believed that David Wildstein was listening or monitoring their phones somehow. I mean, just the degree to which the two sides of this incredibly important government institution didn't trust each other, couldn't work together, were scheming and, you know, backstabbing when they were supposed to be running, you know, the major airports and bridges and tunnels and a subway line in New York City and New Jersey, was just sort of incredible. And that, it just, in addition to everything that Matt said, all of that was really, you know, behind closed doors until it seems people working for Christie, again, according to the government and to the prosecutors, went way too far in one of the things they were doing to try to press his advantage.
Was it New York versus New Jersey, or was it more complicated than that, Ted?
Well, that tension is the story of the Port Authority in any era. It is always a tug of war, and that's partly the way it was set up. The board is evenly divided between New York and New Jersey appointees. The executive positions are essentially evenly divided. And you have this bizarre, to some of us who've covered other government agencies, situation where the board can approve major decisions, but either governor can veto the board's action, and then it just never happened. So it was set up for this kind of, you know, in good times, if the governors are getting along, they can get a lot done, and they have access to tremendous capital and have huge assets. But when the administrations are not getting along, it can go into just total gridlock pretty easily. What happened here was it went beyond the usual tug of war and scratch my back, I'll scratch yours of New York and New Jersey. And really, according to the people we've talked to over the last few years, in those days, the Christie administration and some members of the Christie administration were seen as just kind of running wild within the agency and doing what they wanted. And that certainly that was the New York side's view of David Wildstein, was exactly that he was essentially a rogue operator within the agency. That's how he was described to me by one of the people on the New York side. And that just was causing chaos with not just the political appointees or the people in patronage jobs like Wildstein's, but the people who are career executives who'd been there forever and who were running bridges and who were running airports, and suddenly felt that they were in the middle of, you know, a shooting war among ambitious politicians and didn't know what to do about it.
Let me get Joseph from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us. Hey, Joseph, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
To an extent, you've answered my question, but I'll ask it. I work in a public agency here in Philadelphia. I know when anything happened on the street, we would always get calls from the public, from city officials, from state officials. And there doesn't seem to have been any mechanism in the Port Authority for that, unless I'm a stat. I don't know. It just doesn't sound like it happened.
Well, can you take that, Matt?
Yeah, part of what happened here and part of what exposed the fact that this was not a traffic study, which was the cover story, was that the mayor of Fort Lee, once this traffic jam started calling his contact at the Port Authority, Bill Baroni, and he couldn't get him on the line. And there were increasingly desperate voicemail, email, text messages saying, this is a public safety emergency. What have I done to deserve this? Can you please tell me and call me back? Let me know what's going on. This is people can't get to the hospital. I need help here. And his calls and his messages were forwarded around the bureaucrats within the governor's office and the Port Authority,
but not answered.
He was not answered. And there were actually instructions,
the
mayor of the town, and there were instructions actually not to respond back to him, and the police as well, right?
And the police, yeah.
We have like reams of paper with messages taken for people, the radio silence was the term that was the instruction on how to treat him. And it was only when the New York side of the Port Authority got wind of what was going on that the lanes were reopened.
And this is, to Matt's point, this is a question, probably the question that Bill Baroni, if he goes to trial on this, is going to have to answer. If he's going to go to trial and say, look, guys, as far as I knew, David Wildstein was conducting a traffic study, and gosh, he's a little unorthodox. I just was, you know, being a team player. He's going to have to explain why radio silence seemed reasonable as a response to this, why he couldn't even pick up the phone, why he was talking about putting off meetings with this guy who was saying, have I done something wrong? Am I being punished? I mean, if he can't come up with a good answer to that question, it's sort of tough to see how he explains what he was doing.
Let me read some more comments, and then I'll get some more calls in as well. A comment from Jackie. I'll tell you why this is worth talking about. Christie punished the mayor of Fort Lee for not supporting him in the reelection. Was there some time of quid pro quo expected? Otherwise, I don't understand why there would be any retaliation. An email from Julia. Want to hear about Bridgegate? My thoughts are that it sounds like a report from a third world country where government operates operates not by a code of law, but by bribes and corruption. An email from Liz. I disagree with that Christie and Trump's alliance is the time we live in. That's an acceptance of their tangled web of lies and corruption. An email from Richard. Does anyone really believe that employees under Chris Christie would create a traffic snafu without knowledge and approval of the governor? And Matt, that's one of the unanswered questions about just, I mean, Christie has denied any knowledge of or certainly support of, but that's also one of the driving questions.
For sure. He denied knowledge of it. He made fun of me when I asked about it before the smoking gun came out. He demanded, he predicted that Ted and his colleague at the Wall Street Journal would have to apologize to him for the reports before the smoking gun came out. So he has denied it endlessly. And yet, you know, during a hearing before the smoking gun came out, when the legislature was first looking into this, there was a hearing with Port Authority officials who were revealing for the first time that they didn't know about this traffic study. They were really kind of first exposing the fact that the cover story might not be totally factual. And while that was happening, Christie was exchanging text messages with his incoming chief of staff. And those text messages are gone. Christie and the incoming chief of staff deleted them. Christie says he doesn't remember what was in the text messages, and the incoming chief of staff, Regina Agia, who has since left the administration, she said that it was something about how the people who were testifying were doing a professional job at their testimony. I have plenty more questions for him about what happened, not necessarily before the lane, while the scheme was being concocted or even while the lanes were closed, but more in the 3+ months that passed between the time the lanes closed and the time the smoking gun revealed what had happened and the denials and the alleged cover up. I'm curious about more about what he might have known and been involved in.
And this is a really good point. I mean, the legislative investigation, which produced an interim report, and at which point they basically stopped and said, since we don't have access to everybody who has pled the fifth, this is kind of as far as we can go. But that report, which Christie at times has referred to, he has suggested that it exonerates him or you know, finds him blameless or his administration blameless. If you read the conclusion of that report, it actually is quite damning. It says that various people within the office of the governor, including the entity of the office of the governor, accepted for months a completely ridiculous story that just made no sense and didn't add up, and that at the very best there was very little attempt to get to the bottom of why something that was so illogical was actually an explanation for what had gone on. So to Matt's point, getting beyond the issue of him knowing while they were going on, the question that really remains unanswered is how they could have gone for so long acting like this was nothing and literally ridiculing people who continued to ask about it, when in fact, behind the scenes, we now know they were frantically trying to figure out who had done what.
That's Ted Mann along with Matt Katz giving us all an update on the Bridgegate scandal. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Matt, I know you have to leave in a couple of minutes. We do have a call that has a specific question for you, and then we'll get you out of here. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Yeah, morning. My question is specifically for Matt. Matt, I'm wondering, as a reporter who has covered Chris Christie for quite some time, I'm wondering how your perspective of his political longevity has changed over time, given the experience of Donald Trump and the public support that he's received in spite of the many actions and activities he's engaged in during his campaign.
Go ahead, Matt.
I think Chris's association with Trump has destroyed his favorability and approval ratings that were already going down, but really cemented the fact that Christie will remain in New Jersey for the rest of his term, a relatively unpopular governor. His approval ratings and favorability ratings are now in the 20s, which is horrible. And it's unlikely that he's going to be able to rebound much from that. I don't know if it will have long-term permanent damage to his political reputation. reputation and his political future. We have a short attention span in this country, and it's certainly plausible that he could run again for president in 2020 if circumstances were right and Donald Trump lost. And if Donald Trump were to win, it's certainly plausible that he could be named attorney general or chief of staff in the White House. And in that case, he would get something of a clean slate and get to start a whole new legacy as a political player. But as of now, at least in New Jersey, his reputation has been severely damaged for the long term.
Well, Matt, we have to say goodbye to you. And as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty.
You're welcome. And he has been covering Chris Christie for about 5 years now and currently a reporter for WNYC in New York. Ted Mann staying with us for the rest of the hour. And Ted, we've got, looks like Alice from Doylestown who wants to join our conversation. Alice, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for having my call.
You're
I
welcome.
Apologize. I missed the very beginning of the broadcast, so I'm not sure if you covered this. But is it known if anybody get medical attention or police, attention if needed during the time the bridge was closed? Did anyone die? Are there any possibilities of manslaughter or anything else?
Alice, we touched on that earlier in the hour, but Ted, she asked, did anyone die during that 5-day period as a result of the bridge closure? Do we know?
There's been no determination that anyone died as a result of the bridge closures. I think there was a story back in the fall about, there was an ambulance call that went to, that Matt mentioned an ambulance call that got tied up in traffic and where they had to sort of proceed on foot, which is the most extreme example. It's actually in the email that the executive director sent angrily reversing the closures when he found out about them. He raised this exact question and basically said, you're lucky you didn't kill anybody.
Yeah.
But we don't know that we don't have any evidence that you could tie a death to this, and there's been no indication that manslaughter or anything like that is in the cards.
Ted, I have a really basic question for you, and I probably shouldn't have asked you this an hour ago. So what laws were allegedly broken as a result of this the lane closures?
This is a tough question for the prosecutors. That same email, the initial email reversing them, the executive director said he thought laws had been broken. When he was asked about that later in testimony, he suggested that it could have been the Federal Bridge Act, but that seems to be, not really an issue here. The prosecutors are saying that it was essentially the conspiracy here, and the charge is they're charged with criminal conspiracy, had the result of violating the civil rights of people who were trying to move freely in and around Fort Lee.
Oh, wow.
That is a contention that the defense attorneys basically dismiss. They say that they are trying to create a charge in the federal law that just doesn't exist. Early on, we heard from some people who thought, really, if there is a charge here, state or federal, it'd be more likely to be federal and to be essentially a violation of the code of public office. But one of the big fights in this trial, again, assuming that it does go to trial as it appears it will be whether or not the federal prosecutors are stretching a little bit to turn something that is pretty obviously bad behavior into a crime.
And as I quoted the attorney for Kelly saying, is inconvenience a federal crime? I mean, obviously,
he's
defending her, but he's pushing back on this.
Certainly. And then I think the rebuttal to that is, would the parents of the kids who are on those school buses stuck in traffic for hours on the first day of school really consider this to be just inconvenience?
And one quick question. We're almost out of time here. I'm just curious about the mayor of Fort Lee, Sokolich. What's he been doing for the last couple of years?
I haven't talked to Mark in a while.
Running his city, I guess.
He's been busy. They have been presiding over, and this is sort of implicated in all of this, a tremendous amount of development, including big new buildings that are going up right around the bridge. That was something he mentioned in one of his desperate pleas to Barone, saying, release me from this traffic, and also, what am I supposed to do when all these big buildings we've been building are open and I have all these new residents who are going to be stuck in the middle real as this mess. But, Christie made this very well-covered visit to Sokolic after some of the truth had started to come out to apologize to him in person. And they have been very quiet ever since. Sokolic certainly has kept a relatively low profile.
Well, Ted Mann, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, helping us get through this thicket of twists and turns and new information.
My pleasure.
And he's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. That's it for the first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.